Wildlife, pollution, and nations all show us that borders can disappear without a moment's notice. These days in the Arctic, some of our most compelling problems and our most interesting opportunities seem also to lack traditional borders. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC. Today on Conversations, we'll talk about the Arctic in the 90s and the challenges it presents policymakers, scientists, the environment, and government. My guest today, General Counsel for the Environmental Defense Fund, Scott Hajost. Orrin Young is with us. He is a political scientist and a professor of atmospheric sciences and geophysics, Norbert Untersteiner. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us today. The circumpolar north seems to have changed more in the eye of the beholder than anything else in recent times. Major environmental discoveries or transformations, but moreover, political transformation seems to have made that change. Is that statement accurate in your mind's eye collectively? Has political change been the major change maker in the circumpolar north? Orrin Young, your governmental background makes me turn the question to you first.
Well, I think political change has been a critical factor. We lived for 70 years in a situation in which the two halves of the Arctic, which in many ways are very similar in terms of biological and physical systems, were completely separated in terms of their political, social, and economic experience. And with the end of the Cold War and the decline of the antagonisms that that brought with it, we've now entered an era in which opportunities to communicate, to exchange ideas, even to think about new cooperative mechanisms are bursting out all over. And so it's a period of tremendous excitement for those of us who think about the circumpolar north.
This has to be true in terms of scientific research, Norbert Untersteiner. Is that so from your perspective?
It certainly has recent times opened up new vistas, but the physical scientists have always had a rather unified view of the Arctic, because the atmosphere and the ocean no boundaries, and scientists from all nations have contributed to our knowledge of the Arctic, starting perhaps with the largest increment of knowledge came from Fridtjof Nansen's drift across the Arctic basin, which started just about exactly 100 years ago. So physical scientists have had large international enterprises, such as the first International Polar Year, second International Polar Year, 1931, and then the IGY, International Geophysical Year, 57-58. We have, of course, had our problems. We've lived in the shadow of the Cold War for the last several decades. So it's been a new game for the last two or three years.
And will that affect your working relationships, do you think? Have they been open enough from your perspective?
Oh, yes, they're very open, but of course what is difficult now is that the scientific establishment in Russia is in such difficult straits.
Especially financially, yes.
Yeah.
What's your thought on that opening question, Scott Hajost, once again for the Environmental Defense Fund?
I think that I would agree completely with my two colleagues, is that the demise of the Cold War has really brought a whole new meaning to collective action in the Arctic. In my previous time in the government, I remember when there would be no consideration of collective consideration of environmental protection in the Arctic. The Soviets wanted to do things purely on a bilateral matter. And as the Cold War evaporated, it led to things like the environmental protection strategy that was adopted in 1991. So I think it's really a fundamental shift here and presents new opportunities and vistas for us to act collectively to protect the Arctic environment.
I want to take a look at how the circumpolar north has been seen in past, before this political transformation. Despite cooperation on a scientific level, despite your thinking that the Arctic has been viewed as a whole fabric, at least by that one community, it doesn't seem that it has by the rest of the world. Is that the case?
Let me address that, because it raises a very interesting point that I think many people don't understand. For a long time, there's been a tendency to regard the Arctic as unique, as special, as different, a place of extremes, a place that's where people could get away from the trials and tribulations of the rest of the world. But I think we see more and more, in many respects, there are exciting opportunities in the Arctic to examine questions which are not only important for the Arctic, but are also questions that are of great importance for other parts of the world. For example, the conditions that determine possibilities for international cooperation. It's a very dynamic situation in the Arctic today. Lots of opportunities to learn things that are relevant to other parts of the world.
And what does that mean to you? What
questions of, for example, relationships between different levels of government. Now with the not only the breakdown of the Soviet Union and all the changes that that's bringing regarding the relationship between local governments and the center, but similar things in Canada, where we see now the change of the status of the Northwest Territories, the whole question of the devolution of power and authority. These are questions which are of great importance to people all around the world. And I think the real opportunities in the Arctic to examine issues that are not only profoundly important for the Arctic, but in which the Arctic can be a kind of a model in which we can look at issues that are of great importance far beyond the confines of the Arctic.
Can I just add a point to that? I mean, one of the important discussions during preparations for the Rio Earth Summit was indeed the role of indigenous peoples. And there's a whole chapter in what is called Agenda 21 of the Rio Earth Summit, which is the 500-some pages of recommendations of how to promote environment and development. In fact, some of the native peoples from the Arctic participated in Rio. And it's interesting, I'd agree completely what was just said, is that the Arctic presents a real test case, including internationally, multilaterally, how you implement some of those recommendations to involve the native peoples in decision-making over the lands and resources in which they've lived for centuries and will for some time.
What is the likelihood of that? The Native people have a very different perspective from Western thinking. They're also relatively few people relative to the whole. And in the past, they've been kind of passed by the race car of the industrial world.
They have a different and I don't know what the technical term is, but maybe a more holistic view of nature. They look at the trees and the sedges in the tundra and the lakes and the sky and the wind and the temperature and the permafrost and the what all at the same time, and perceive that and will note that well, when they were kids, they could always see the island on the other side, but now they can't see it anymore because the turbidity of the atmosphere has increased. Some gentleman just this afternoon said, "You know that this year, for this time of year, the leaves are a lot greener than they normally are." Well, that's because I'm not even sure why that is. It has something to do with the moisture budget in the ground. We have to isolate these things painstakingly by making long observations. A person living in harmony and connected with his or her entire environment makes these observations so naturally. And one of the recommendations that we're going to come up with is that we must make sure that this kind of knowledge is preserved and is documented and is also translated into forms and codes that are readable by people from other cultures.
Let me interrupt long enough just to say Norbert Untersteiner is with us from the University of Washington. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences and geophysics. Also with us, Orrin Young, who is a research professor of government at Dartmouth. And Scott Hajost comes to us as the general counsel of the Environmental Defense Fund. Orrin, please continue.
Let me come back to this question about indigenous people, because I think it's a fascinating phenomenon. It's particularly interesting to a political scientist like myself. The native peoples have very few votes. They're small in number. And relatively speaking, they're material resources. They don't have a lot of money. And yet, in some sense, they've been remarkably effective. They've been successful in terms of promoting their concerns beyond what one would have casually predicted from accounting of their numbers and their resources. And that leads to the question, why is this so? What have they got that's been the source of this effectiveness? One thing is, I think they've done a very good job at organizing themselves, not only nationally but transnationally. It's a remarkable phenomenon of things like the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and now increasingly linkages between the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and other organizations of indigenous peoples, both in the north and in other parts of the world. They've been very sophisticated in using the mechanisms of the United Nations to get their message across. And in some way, I think perhaps they've also had some success in capturing the imagination of people who are not natives themselves, but who have some kind of residual sense in their mind that these people are impressive, that they are people to be respected, and so on. But this question of how have they been able to achieve what they have achieved, I think, is a very intriguing one, and one that might produce insights for all of us.
Can I just add a point to that? You mentioned the impact and use of the United Nations system. I think that I've witnessed that not only in the native peoples of the Arctic, but also other indigenous peoples, whether it's the Sarawak of Malaysia. It's an opportunity for them to get a message across in an international forum, and indeed to have some impact on policies that may affect their own national governments, when at times their own national governments will not give them their say in the formulation of national policy. And I think it's a very important development.
So interestingly enough, indigenous peoples may have a greater impact on an international scene than they might each in their separate national scenes?
Well, I'm not sure if it's either or, but I think sometimes by going international, it's a way in the long run of backing their national governments into commitments that it gets more and more embarrassing for them to get out of. So, for example, Scott mentioned Agenda 21. Well, they got a lot of language into Agenda 21 to articulate their interests, their concerns, their agenda. Now, some people might say cynically, well, so what? Agenda 21 isn't a legally binding document. It doesn't compel people to do things. And yet, it sets the stage. It defines the terms. And more policymakers in various communities are going to be hard-pressed. They're going to have to explain why they're going against this, why they're not taking it seriously. And when you have to explain that, you find it harder and harder, or more and more awkward or embarrassing to ignore those formulas altogether.
This brings me to a question that arouses my curiosity, and that is, what are the chances of the holistic view that you describe, Norbert Untersteiner, and the emerging political clout that you describe, Orrin Young, and you describe, Scott Hajost, having an impact on Western thinking, let us say, in environmental policy internationally?
Well, you know, we are the so-called Western disciplinary science is coming around a lot to this holistic view. It's called, on the campuses across the country, it's called interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary view. We're under pressure even from our administrators, from the funding agencies, not to be too parochial, not to look only at our segment of a particular specialty, but to look across. And of course, it's happening. There are chemists working in oceanography and chemists working in atmospheric science and biologists. You know, there are geological oceanographers and chemical oceanographers and physical oceanographers. So the boundaries, the walls between disciplines are crumbling. We still have to, you know, you cannot learn everything, and you cannot teach a student everything. You have to structure the training of students in a certain way. But the need to look at a phenomenon in a comprehensive way is upon us, and we have to make an effort to grasp a broader picture than we've been used to.
Still, I think it comes hard. We need to make a sustained effort to do this. And I think that one of the critical things is to begin to acknowledge and to accept the complementarities in our different kinds of knowledge. That is, that each side has some insights, some kinds of knowledge that the other side doesn't have. For example, when you look at things like the population dynamics of animals, species, the Western scientific tradition tends to have a very good comparative knowledge. That is, people have looked at similar animal populations or stocks in a number of different places and can compare and contrast what they see in different places. But indigenous peoples who've been there for a long time tend to have remarkably good information about the sort of long-term trends and fluctuations in these populations. I see that as a great complementarity. It seems to me that we're likely to understand what's going to happen in the future better if we put these two things together. The comparative perspective and the what scientists call longitudinal, meaning the long-term trend type of perspective over a period of time, and say, by combining these things, we're going to get better insights. And once we acknowledge the complementarity, and that is to say the contributions that each group can make, it seems to me then we'll have a basis for some very real partnership, mutual respect, and a real improvement in the way we do things.
Scott Hajost.
Well, I have to agree completely with that. Every forum that I work in, I think there's increasing recognition of not only the need, but the importance of taking into account traditional knowledge and practices, and indeed anecdotal information that indigenous peoples may have. And I think that's reflected, including throughout the documents we're prepared for Rio.
You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Today we're talking about the Arctic and its impact on a changing world, a changing Arctic and its impact on the world, I think. Old policy, it seems to me, that may be going out of usefulness at this point, at least in this country, whether it was environmental policy or international relations policy, was seemingly based on national security first. Someone else was going to hurt us if we didn't protect ourselves. With the changing political scene, with new awareness about environmental issues, economic opportunities, is this changing? And how, gentlemen?
Dr. Oh, it's been changing very much. It's really interesting because the United States and Soviet governments signed a bilateral treaty on environmental issues. I can't remember the exact title, in 1971. And there have been working groups and mutual visits ever since that time with the purpose of agreeing on certain procedures to protect or preserve the environment and to exchange research results and data. The exchange of data has been a mere trickle until perestroika. It was extremely difficult or impossible to get any, for instance, any oceanographic information out of the Soviets. And it has been almost a flood of information coming our way, because they always had access to our unclassified information. So it's a completely new environment the Russians are clamoring for cooperative and collaborative efforts with us, and many of them are in the United States at any given time, I would guess hundreds. And not just for a few days, for a year or two, for well-planned joint research activities. So it really has been very encouraging in that regard.
Change in focus, since national security may not be our major concern, Orin Young?
Well, I think there's no doubt about that. But it opens the way for some new perspectives, which I think confirm what Norbert was saying, really have great cooperative potential. For example, there now is a very rapidly growing interest in trying to improve our understanding of the role of the Arctic in global change. And these are very large systemic kinds of phenomena which lend themselves very well to collaboration rather than competition. And we see rapid development of cooperative projects at a number of levels to try to understand the role of the Arctic in global change. Particularly interesting because while the driving forces behind global change are mostly not Arctic, the impacts of global change are likely to show up particularly quickly and dramatically in the Arctic. And so we will begin to see the consequences of human behavior in a dramatic sort of way in the Arctic, and we will find ourselves needing to respond sooner or more quickly in the Arctic than would be the case in the mid-latitudes. And this, too, I think, is likely to provide a new agenda, a new perspective in which the old sort of security confrontations are a thing of the past, and we start to talk about mechanisms to manage cooperative practices to deal with these new kinds of concerns.
Do you think that means the environment is emerging as the car in which policymaking is driven?
Well, I've taken the viewpoint, I look at this more broadly even in the Arctic, that once again, with the demise of the Cold War, economic, environmental issues, trade move more to the forefront of what really is important, including in how you define national security. You move away from an east-west conflict and trying to find east-west, north-south cooperation. That is, cooperation among the former countries of the Soviet Union, Central Europe, developing countries, and industrialized countries into, at times we call this a global partnership, in which environment becomes much more important. Looking at it narrowly in the Arctic, one of the things we're discussing here at this conference and is on the table is the original 1983, or it wasn't the original because there's a predecessor, decision from the National Security Council on defining Arctic policy. And this evening we were having a discussion about what that means and what should be and how should you redefine U.S. national security interests in the Arctic. And I think there is a clear sense that it's shifting away from one of military conflict with the Russians to cooperation, and two, in which ecological protection and environment development and protection of human health and the well-being of native peoples moves to the forefront.
Is this a window, this moment in time? And I should say both Norbert and Scott have referred to this conference. This is being recorded on the 13th day of August, 1992. The conference is the Arctic Perspectives Conference, which held at the University of Alaska Fairbanks during this week to talk about policies for the Arctic, environmental, governmental, economic at all. Does this mean that this moment in time is a rather enormous window of opportunity to mold the way the peoples of the world will deal with each other in the future? That is to say, to short circuit opportunities for distrust and distress in the future and to create more opportunities or bind us to ways to deal with each other in a civilized way? Scott?
Well, I think you do have a window. It's more than a window of opportunity, but I think it's one that is here and it's time to seize. If I can give it in just in sort of a narrow perspective on this, I recently participated in the Munich Group of Seven Economic Summit, and one of the key questions there was aid to Russia. And I ended up listening to Boris Yeltsin and Chancellor Kohl's press briefing, and I think the position that we took there, along with a number of others, that it's absolutely vital to try and do as much as possible to assist the Russians in their redevelopment, not only from an economic, environmental point of view, but an overall political point of view, to really to establish the basis for that firm cooperation and to work with the West, indeed, in partnerships and looking north and south.
Let me suggest another way in which I think this is an unusual period and a period of opportunity. So long as security was the dominant concern, it tended to reinforce the monopoly of national governments on policy and policymaking. Security is the be-all and end-all of national governments. But now that that set of considerations has declined, and now that we've moved on to these other kinds of issues of the environment, sustainable development, indigenous rights, and so on, we're witnessing a situation in which other kinds of players are becoming more prominent and more significant. People are no longer willing to defer to the national government to accept that the national government has a monopoly on international or transnational activities in a region like the Arctic. So, for example, we see subnational governments, states, counties, provinces, and so on, starting to interact with each other, starting to take the initiative on their own, starting to develop cooperative projects independent of their national governments. And we see non-governmental organizations and activities beginning to expand in this area also. So in a way, this creates a kind of a messier situation. It's not quite as neat and straightforward as the good old world of nation states, but in other respects, I think it's very exciting. It creates opportunities. It allows new arenas in which different kinds of players and stakeholders can take the initiative, can begin to explore common interests on their own.
It's not like a window. It's like the whole wall fell out.
Right. Huh. So you're rebuilding the wall to suit the new time.
Well, in a different wall.
Different wall.
So it's not just rebuilding the wall. Here's a chance to reconfigure, in a sense, and allow different groups with different bases of interest to become significant players.
But the natural province of governments, national being our readiest example, is to hang on to power and to kind of keep all those pesky people with their other points of view out of the way. What are the chances of this decentralization functioning?
Well, I think on our side, research is essentially funded by the federal government. The federal government makes the research policy. The federal government has the money, but we can talk rationally to our government. Our government gets a lot of advice. I think it gets a lot more advice than it knows what to do with. But it was interesting to hear Oren mention the proliferation of agreements and deals cut not on the national-to-national government level, but on all levels. We have just, the University of Washington, we have just signed some kind of memorandum of understanding with the Arctic and Antarctic Research Institute in St. Petersburg. It means absolutely nothing to us, but it means quite a lot to them, because they can say, well, you know, we have this deal with the University of Washington, and we have to get our exit visa, and we have to get a little hard currency per diem, because we have to visit them, because we are planning something. That would have been totally unthinkable. Anything that was not sanctioned by the highest authority, if possible by some nameless authority, because in that kind of system nobody could be responsible or wanted to be held responsible in case anything goes wrong. It would have been unthinkable before the end of the Cold War. And it has really opened up free movement of people, free movement of ideas, and it will enable us to give some more support to the scientific establishment in Russia. And as somebody said today at the meeting, Russia needs the scientific establishment to develop their democratic institutions.
This is Conversations. Gentlemen, if you will, I'd like to take a case, a situation, and take a look at it from each from your different perspectives. The situation is the recently acknowledged information that for the past several decades, the Soviet Union has been, by both accident and purpose, dumping a great deal of radioactive material into its waterways which roam around and eventually spill themselves into the Arctic Ocean, Bering Sea, other areas that affect the United States, will affect Canada, will affect Greenland, will affect the Scandinavian countries. So what we have here is an enormous set of errors that will impact the world in terms of decision-making, policy, and action. How does this transformed international scene begin to deal with this? Your thoughts? Scott Hajost.
I can give you a few thoughts, not necessarily as a scientist. I can tell you how it's affected some of our activities at the Environmental Defense Fund. One, we're trying to obtain as much information and map it as we can. We have a fair amount of contact with some of the Russian scientists. And a fairly strong belief needs to be a much, in a good effort to try and monitor the potential implications for the marine environment in the Arctic. One of the thoughts we've had actually is, and there's a Norwegian vessel I think that's just left recently to try and monitor the Soviet sub that's lying off of what's the name of the Norwegian island? A feeling that there should be a stronger role for this recently created Arctic Monitoring Assessment Program, maybe collectively, to provide a basis to monitor the potential impacts on the Arctic. Now, from a more legal point of view, we've been in touch with the International Maritime Organization and understand the Secretary General is going to be of the International Maritime Organization is going to be writing to the Russian Federation to ask for more details about when, what amounts have been dumped at sea. Depending on the time frames at which some of the dumping took place, it raises some serious questions about implementation of the London Ocean Dumping Convention. And that's a major question right now for the treaty parties to the London Ocean Dumping Convention as to whether they're going to ban formally all radioactive waste disposal at sea. And information coming to light that the Russians may have been dumping it and not reporting it is a really critical issue. And clearly,
literally, sorry. Because too much has gone in for what they think the ocean can handle?
Not necessarily because too much has gone in. And once again, it comes down to the time frames because there's a voluntary moratorium that was adopted in 1983 in the London Ocean Dumping Convention. The U.S. voted against it but has not acted inconsistently with it. It says you won't dump low-level radioactive waste. The treaty prohibits any high-level radioactive waste dumping at sea. And so if there's been dumping that's taken place since 1983, it would not have been in compliance with that voluntary moratorium. And I guess equally importantly, there is not necessarily a record of any reporting, even if it was done as required under the treaty, this occurred. Now, I don't know the facts and details. We're still trying to get that because it will, if it comes out right, be an important consideration this fall when the treaty parties meet again in London. But it clearly, I have to say, just from where I sit even in Washington, it has elevated the concern of the Arctic. It's really got a lot more attention to it, and that's one of the reasons Senator Murkowski is having a hearing, which we're going to testify on the 15th, is because of the perceived threat to the Arctic of this radioactive material.
Once again, this event will have gone to the past by the time we are speaking to you, the audience, on this program. Nonetheless, I think the information is all timely.
Let me suggest another consequence of this particular case. For a long time in dealing with pollution, both at home and internationally, we've tended to base our thinking on principles like the polluter pays principle in certain notions of liability, and how can we enforce these sorts of rules. I think a case like this is a very dramatic illustration of a more widespread phenomenon, which is to say that more and more we're going to have to think of ways in which we can cooperate with the polluter in order to achieve common interests. Take this case. And it's not going to be enough simply to produce some documents which say that a violation of a rule has occurred and it's therefore the responsibility of the Russians to clean this up immediately. What we're going to have to do, and what I think is more and more feasible to do in the new international climate, is to go in and say, look, how can we cooperatively design a program, first of all, to map the nature of the problem, to identify the sites, and then to work together to figure out how to solve this problem, how to deal with the radioactive waste, what remedial steps to take. And I think this is going to be more and more characteristic, in which we're not looking at a sort of a situation of policing rules against lawbreakers, but looking at ways in which we can work together to solve problems which, although they may have caused it, we're all in this boat together, and we need to work cooperatively to promote our common interests in solving the problem.
Norbert, understand.
In this most unfortunate circumstances, there is one bright aspect, and that is that the very problems that we have with this radioactive pollution and with trying to figure out what the risks are, that very problem is also at the heart of our global change and our Arctic circulation problem. We have been trying to understand how the Arctic Ocean and the adjacent Arctic seas interact with the world ocean. And some extremely important facts have turned up a few years ago, which indicate that most of the deep water of the whole world ocean is generated in the northernmost North Atlantic. That is also a region where these radioactively contaminated waters will eventually pass through the system and leak out into the world ocean. So we have been, in principle, studying the very mechanisms that we now must study at an accelerated pace to determine, first of all, what the risks. After we know what's there, well, there's still some work to be done along that line. But once we know what is there, we will then have to figure out what the risks are for the adjacent oceanic regions and the beaches. And of course, in order to do that, we have to have mathematical models of this circulation. That's what we have been doing, except we're going to have to do it a little faster and with a greater degree of urgency now.
Can I come back to this just one second? Is that all right?
Scott Hayden.
Okay. I'd like to agree with Thorne that, yes, we need to approach it on a cooperative basis. It's in part very much in our self-interest to do so, interest in environmental protection, health, et cetera. That was one of the reasons why the industrialized countries are prepared to help Russia dealing with the Chernobyl-type nuclear power plants, either hopefully phasing them out through improvements in energy efficiency and maybe upgrading some of the others until they can be phased out, because it really is a time bomb that is there that could affect the environment. At the same time, I also look at this as an international lawyer, and while I want to see cooperation, I don't want to deny the further development of the responsibilities for good reporting, for compliance with treaty obligations, and potential future liability down the road. Having gone through the Chernobyl incident, we know that none of the countries presented a claim to the Soviet Union. Lots of discussions. I participated in numerous symposia looking at the international liability questions. From a foreign policy, political point of view, nobody presented a claim, but I don't want to ever put too far off the shelf the fact that there are some international legal principles here at play as well.
What is the advantage to the international community if claims are levied against the country which committed the environmental damage? What's the advantage to the international community?
If you look at it in terms of what I already mentioned, the polluter pays. In terms of the polluter providing the damage, it's the one usually should make the restitution. Now, in this case, it probably isn't going to be in anybody's interest necessarily to pursue that, because your interest is trying to find out the scope of the problem and do whatever is necessary to address it in the first instance. And if we're frank, and you look at the state of Russia right now, it's not exactly in the best position, even if you presented a claim to pay for something. So you have to have a little bit of practicality at the same time.
But you just don't want to lose the guideline.
There may be appropriate cases in which you would want to present a claim. I mean, I can go back to another example, the Ixtoc blowout in the Gulf of Mexico back in 1980. The U.S. ended up suing one of the subcontractors in federal court, but it chose not to go against the Mexican state oil company, once again, for a variety of reasons. But at least the basis for a claim was maintained.
Okay. Scott Hajost, once again, is with the Environmental Defense Fund. Norbert, I want to return to you in this way that we're kind of leapfrogging each other on this subject of this nuclear pollution problem. What's your level of optimism? Do you think that scientific research can accelerate, can get going fast enough to be able to guide those who will actually do the mopping up to do it correctly?
Absolutely. I think the scientific research that needs to be done is not going to be very expensive compared to the cost of mopping up, for instance. Because mopping up means many ships, means expensive dredging operations. It means also then safely putting away what you have dredged up, which means transporting it to sites on land. This is going to be a massively expensive enterprise. In comparison, the research needed to do the risk assessment is going to be minor.
The problem I see in this really has to do with the mopping up rather than the scientific research. I mean, we know that Russia is undergoing a tremendous transformation in which the pressures are enormous to use what resources they have to turn around their economy, to show progress toward the institutional change that has been talked about these last few years. mopping up the consequences of the past is something that is likely not to be at the top of the politicians' agendas, because however important it is to the world, it's not going to transform the economy and get the Russian economy moving again. So the question then is, what can we in the rest of the world do to influence what happens there? I think we can do things. I mean, unlike the past 70 years, we are in a period when we have remarkable leverage, and not necessarily because of citing certain laws, although I don't disagree with Scott's concern for them, but we have leverage because they need our help. And we can certainly say, look, we are willing to consider aid of various kinds, but there are certain things that are very important to us that you need to deal with. Make credible and serious promises to take environmental concerns seriously in a lot of places, of which the nuclear contamination in the Arctic is a particularly prominent example, and one I think that has a lot of sort of potential for mobilizing public opinion, because nuclear scares are things that people get anxiety ridden about. So I think that one of the good news, in a sense, is that we might take this as an opportunity to try to bring pressure to bear to maximize the likelihood that certain kinds of changes, policy changes, take place within Russia in the context of this kind of environmental concern.
Well, but once again, the Arctic is not all that close to what you think of as the centers of power, Washington, D.C., or London, or we can list the major cities of the world, which, if threatened by nuclear contamination, intimately might respond.
But that's why
we going to respond?
Why the fact that this is a nuclear contamination, I think, is particularly important. Mm-hmm. I think publics get exercised about nuclear contamination.
Of these things are water soluble. They go into the global ocean. They are taken up by living organisms over years. Some of them have half lives of tens of thousands of years, some of these substances. So we're talking about a potential long term leakage of these terrible substances into the living organisms in the ocean.
Does this rank with the greatest environmental disasters of our time?
I think we don't know. It might be exaggerated to classify it that dramatically at this point, but it is certainly a very serious issue.
One of the things that I want to stress here, too, is that from what we know at this point, part of this, some of it is a disaster that's happened already. Some of it, I think, is a disaster that's waiting to happen. For example, there are quite a lot of decommissioned nuclear-powered submarines sitting in Murmansk Fjord. They haven't, for the most part, started to leak yet, but they're a time bomb. And it's just possible that there still is time to head off some of the worst of that disaster waiting to happen. I mean, it is mopping up, but there's an element of this which is getting in there in a timely manner to arrive at some agreement as to how to deal with the time bomb that hasn't gone off yet, which could go off within a relatively short period of time, 6 months, a year, 5 years. It's something that could happen very soon if we don't seize the opportunity to deal with it in a constructive way quickly.
Gentlemen, I want to break off long enough to take a moment to reintroduce you all to our audience. The last speaker is Dr. Oren Young. He is the director of the Institute of Arctic Studies at Dartmouth College. His specialty is government. He is a research professor at Dartmouth, also an author on the subject. His last two books include Arctic Politics, Conflict and Cooperation in the Circumpolar North, which will be out in January of 93. The Age of the Arctic, Hot Conflicts and Cold Realities was published in 1989. Is that accurate, Oren?
That's correct.
That's it. Okay. Scott Hajost is with us. As I mentioned, he's International Counsel for the Environmental Defense Fund. The Environmental Defense Fund is a major non-governmental public interest environmental group. Scott's specialty, climate change and other international environmental issues. He's recognized as an expert on Antarctic and Arctic marine environmental affairs, formerly with the EPA, now with the EDF. Norbert Untersteiner is with us. He is the chair of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Washington, a professor of atmospheric sciences and geophysics. He serves as the vice chair of the Polar Research Board and also vice president of the International Arctic Science Committee. Much of his published work is on ice and sea ice in the world. Yeah. Gentlemen, to turn this discussion slightly, I don't want to leave our environmental focus at all, but it has been said that with increasing population in the world, with declining resources around the rest of the world, that the resources of the Arctic, once again throughout the circumpolar region, will be much more exploited in coming decades. First of all, do each of you see that as true? And secondly, development in our peculiar past has almost always been associated with exploitation. What are the chances that we can march once again into this new era in a civilized way? Scott, to you, development yeah. without exploitation?
Development without exploitation. Well, in part, I guess one of the questions would be, which type of resources are you talking about? Some of the renewable resources that are in the Arctic, such as fish stocks, which are severely stressed right now, for example, in the Bering Sea. Or are you talking about oil and gas development, coal, et cetera? I think it's probably no secret that organizations like the Environmental Defense Fund are not very enthused about seeing increased oil development in the Arctic, and believe quite strongly that what we should be promoting is increased energy efficiency and renewable resources, and that indeed is not only in our environmental and economic, but in our strategic interests. I think it all is going to go to a question which in part what the Rio Earth Summit was about, and the whole concept of sustainable development. And bringing that from this conceptual stage into reality as to how we consume resources, including in this country, and whether we're doing so on a sustainable basis. And I think that there's a long way to go on this, both in the Arctic as well as in the lower 48 states, whether it's agriculture or anything else. And so I think one of the things we'll have to look at is an overall strategy for development at some point in the Arctic. That's been one of the proposals for implementation of the Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy, and should be at the forefront, in my viewpoint, as the U.S. looks at a new Arctic policy.
Let's separate these two things out and deal first with the question of sustainable development, if we can. And secondly, and without forgetting it, I want to take a look at the standoff between development and environment.
Of course, I'm not an expert in this area, but it strikes me that sustainable development is something that we can afford to cherish. If I were a resident of Somalia, I would not be terribly interested in sustainable development. I would be interested in getting a roof over my head and enough to eat for my children and for me. And the number of poor people in the world is so enormously large that my feeling is, and this is my pure lay opinion, it's going to be impossible to slow down the development of fossil fuels, because standard of living means energy. There is no way to improve the standard of living of the poor people of this earth without giving them in some form more energy. So I believe there is a very serious situation. I'd be happy to be corrected by the experts.
Orin, your expertise?
Well, I think we may see different outcomes in different places. If you're looking at the gas reserves of northwestern Siberia, I can't see any scenario under which there won't be large-scale exploitation, almost certainly by the end of this decade.
No matter what, because we can't change our ways?
Because the energy requirements of rebuilding the Russian economy will be so unstoppable, will be so persistent, so intense. And the resources are proven. Some of the fields are already under production. It's a relatively short distance in terms of infrastructure, transportation corridors, and so on, from the current fields like Jomberg, to the next ones that have already been identified. I should say that there's been a remarkable increase in sort of political controversy within Russia regarding that issue, but I think the imperatives of reconstruction, redevelopment, will be unstoppable in that case. On the other hand, if you look at renewable resources, let's say the fish stocks of the Bering Sea, I think that we've probably already reached a point of severe danger of declining yields from the Bering Sea ecosystem, which is one of the most biologically productive ecosystems in the world. And I think that there may well be a fairly rapid increase in concern about that and awareness that we need to look at the Bering Sea as a system and not just to look at how much we can exploit from the pollock stock. I see a number of indications in Washington and in Alaska and in Russia, too, of a willingness to take a new look at the Bering Sea. Now, that's not going to change overnight some of the political imperatives of the industry that's involved there, but I think that there will be some new perspectives there and a willingness to rethink that issue and try to understand that complex ecosystem in a much more sophisticated way than we've been thinking about it for the last 20 or 30 years that I know about it.
Can I return to the energy issue just for a moment? If we look at it from a global warming point of view, clearly natural gas, which may be a substitute for coal and oil, it has much less what we call greenhouse gas potential. It is global warming. It doesn't contribute as much to global warming. And indeed, one of the scenarios as a bridge to greater use of renewable resources for energy production is to increase the production of natural gas. And that could come from Siberia. The question is, do you price it properly? And two, do you have sufficient controls to ensure you don't have significant methane leakage? Because methane itself is a very important and potent global warming gas. But exports of natural gas from Russia, I assume, will occur at some point in time. I think some of the Europeans are looking to that as a source, indeed, for them to reduce their own greenhouse gas emissions. Now, turning to other developing countries, true, it's clear. You need electricity. China is going to want to put refrigerators in. It's going to want to have electricity. India. I can remember when I was the associate administrator at EPA International, I met with an Indian environment minister before he met with the administrator. And he said, it's interesting to fly from New York to Washington at night. Said, it looks like one city with all the lights. I can fly across many parts of India, and I don't see any lights. And it's a legitimate interest.
Same story.
Clearly. And it's recognized, and including, I keep going back to Rio, but energy was a major issue in Rio, including its relationship to climate. But it's a big development issue, and there's ways you can increase that energy supply through better technologies, through better pricing, demand-side efficiency, and that's what we've been pushing for the World Bank to do bilaterally, indeed in developing countries. You make the most efficient energy investments even while you're having to increase possibly for some time your use of fossil fuels.
Let me come back to this issue of that both Norbert and Scott have raised about the implications of the North-South issue for the Arctic. I see a couple of different scenarios here, and some of them are more optimistic than others. One thing that could happen is that the Arctic countries, which are all northern industrial countries, and many of which, not all of which, but many of which have been relatively dependent upon sources of fossil fuels like the Middle East, could say, well, the solution for us is to form an Arctic club in which we exploit the very large recoverable reserves of hydrocarbons in the Arctic, relatively secure, geopolitically not subject to the disruptions and so on of the Middle East, and forget about the South. And that would be a very unfortunate scenario, but one that I could conceive of happening. The other scenario is to say, is there some way in which the Arctic could play a role in trying to develop new innovative thinking about the global system and the global political economy? Can we learn lessons from the Arctic and its very sensitive ecosystems, which would not only be useful in terms of managing the Arctic better, but which would give us a better handle on what we should and shouldn't do in other parts of the world. In the long run, as Norbert suggests with his example of Somalia, if sustainable development means anything, it means that we will all have to learn to not only accept but to be satisfied with a less materialistic lifestyle, a lifestyle in which sustainable development is not a synonym for sustainable economic growth, but for a different way of life that the planet can sustain.
That's right. But considering how few of us live really high on the hog, and how many of us are very poor and need an enormous catch-up, I think the prospects don't look so good.
Well, and I'm very concerned, certainly in this country, with a certain political tendency to secure our own lifestyle and not worry very much about what happens to the rest of the world. I mean, I'm not saying that's what will happen, but I think unless we're very conscious of this issue and work hard to deal with it, that there's a very real political tendency to say, let us secure our own lifestyle, our own privileged situation, and minimize our exposure, our vulnerability to what goes on in the rest of the world.
I think that is right on point. And if you looked at all the 2 years leading up to the Rio Earth Summit, that clearly was an underlying policy of how the administration approached the conference. And it was basically, we don't change anything. Everything stays the same for us and the rest of the world. Well, maybe you'll improve poverty somehow, et cetera. But there's no change in lifestyles here, no real change in consumption. We know that's absolutely critical. And I think that we were reminded, it was interesting, by the Secretary General of the UN as well as the conference, that this is going to be, in the long run, unsustainable, and we'll all suffer eventually.
Sure, yeah.
And isn't this attitude kind of a redefinition of the Cold War, which is to say, I got mine? No comment.
Well, it's a very profound political division, and it represents a fundamentally different vision of how we are to proceed. One vision is how can we make darn sure that we protect our privileged situation.
Maybe I wouldn't call it political. It's based on greed. You know, it's more universal than political. It's just greed. I got mine, and well, maybe you get yours with luck, but not at my expense, and that was the spirit.
Gentlemen, on that very dour note,
we have, can't continue any further on that note.
We've spent our hour. I want to thank you all. Scott Hajos from the Environmental Defense Fund, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Orrin Young from Dartmouth, Institute of Arctic Studies, thank you, Orrin. Norbert Untersteiner from the University of Washington. Thank you all, gentlemen. This has been Conversations. I hope you'll join me again next week. I'm Susan McInnes.